In order to be successful, sometimes you have to do different things. And you have to know when to do the different thing.
That's Jory Clark, a top 50 business thinker, best-selling author, and branding expert. Through years of work with clients and her own experiences, she's observed the many challenges that we often face in reaching our long-term goals. Too often, we focus on the need to get those big wins fast or feel the pressure to take a path that is seemingly easy or more guaranteed. But to really achieve that lasting success, we have to reframe how we look at progress and what we really want to achieve.
And so if you place little bets, it literally doesn't matter if you fail, because failure is too big of a term for whatever has happened. There are always multiple paths to success.
So what does it take to break that cycle and shift to being that long-term thinker in a short-term world? Welcome to Strategic Momentum, the podcast that helps you achieve meaningful work-life fit in an ever-changing world through the inspiring stories, actionable tips, and pragmatic advice behind those that found it. I'm your host, Connie Steele. Dory Clark has built quite a portfolio career since her early days as a journalist and presidential campaign spokeswoman. As someone who has reached the pinnacle of success in the business world, her journey wasn't a linear one, and she continues to build upon her incredible career mashup, which also includes being a professor at Duke and Columbia, a frequent contributor to Harvard Business Review, and the host of Better, a weekly LinkedIn Live interview show for Newsweek. She has three best-selling books, Entrepreneurial You, Reinventing You, and Stand Out. And her latest book, The Long Game, How to Be a Long-Term Thinker in a Short-Term World, launches today. I had a chance to read it, and I felt it really spoke to the moment that we are in right now. And today, Dory is going to share some of the valuable insights and perspectives from this new book. And along the way, we're going to hear about Dory's career mashup journey and how becoming a long-term thinker helped her get to where she is today. Dory, I am so excited to have you on the show today.
Hey, Connie, I'm really glad to be talking with you.
So I am a huge personal fan. I discovered your work way back when, in HBR, actually. It was all about branding, and have since read all three of your books. And it's been an inspiration for me trying to figure out what my portfolio career might be and what I could potentially be that recognized expert in. But you know, what's so important for me is to make sure that everybody else knows your really amazing journey. So I'd love it if you could please share your career journey and those important milestones that have led you to where you are today.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll try to be brief, and we can go into more depth for any of it if you'd like. But broadly speaking, I grew up in North Carolina. I went off to college early. I went to divinity school and thought I was going to be a professor, but I got turned down by all of the doctoral programs that I applied to. So I had to think fast. And after a few career quick changes, none of which seemed to quite take, I was laid off as a journalist, and I worked doing press on various political campaigns that didn't work. I ended up starting my own business, which I've now run for the past 15 years. And so I do a mix of consulting, executive coaching, business school teaching for Duke and Columbia, and keynotes, you know, when there's not COVID, and writing books. And my latest one, which is just coming out September 2021, it's called The Long Game, How to Be a Long-Term Thinker in a Short-Term World.
Well, you've created such an incredible portfolio career because you are author, speaker, consultant, Thinkers 50, also Grammy winning producer. Is that correct? And I know you have this passion for Broadway, and you've also continued to talent stack in a way that is pretty amazing because you've developed this incredible breadth in addition to depth. So I'd love to hear, how do you feel this career mashup, I'd like to call it, has enabled you to build this level of personal and professional momentum for yourself, which has translated into this amazing impact that you've had on others?
Thank you. Well, ultimately, part of it is that I have a lot of interests. And because I don't want to get bored, I like to do a lot of things. And I think probably a lot of folks can relate to that. Also, I was laid off from my first job as a reporter, and it really stayed with me. It took me some time to operationalize that, but it really meant that very viscerally, I felt the reality of what it means to have your job vanish. And so it made me want to be smart about how to protect myself from that in the future and how to hedge those risks. And so as time went on and my business grew, I really made a point of trying to develop multiple revenue streams because I realized that's where the security comes from. It comes from having multiple clients and it comes from having multiple different things you do for those clients. And so in fact, my past book that I wrote, Entrepreneurial You, is really about this question of how do you create additional revenue streams in your business? Because I believe that even if you work for a company and have a day job, it is a good idea to have some kind of a side gig because it gives you both the potential to get economic upside and a way to protect yourself just in case the unforeseen happens.
And we know today uncertainty is the new certainty, particularly given obviously the world around us is so unpredictable. And I think many of us are feeling that way ourselves. And so to learn from somebody like you who learned early on that you have to take stock in your own career, went through that experience of being laid off, and I've been laid off too. And it's really jarring the first time it happens to you that all you know is taking a very linear path to getting there. It's not until you actually take a step back and kind of reframe the way that you could approach your career, do you realize, oh, wait, there's a fundamentally different avenue to find ultimately what fits. And it's actually not a short-term thing. It's actually sort of a longer-term game that you need to think about ultimately to get you there. So, which leads me to, you have a great new book that launches today called The Long Game. And it's such a powerful book that provides these principles and frameworks on what it takes to create that lasting success in a very short-term focused world that we're all in. I'd love you to tell us more about the book as well as that inspiration behind writing it in the first place.
Yeah. So I got excited about the idea of writing The Long Game a few years ago because as I was working with executive coaching clients, folks in my Recognize Expert community, which is the online course and community that I run, I began seeing patterns. And this was something that I had experienced myself years ago. And then seeing it in other folks, I realized, oh, okay, this is a thing, which is for a lot of really smart and capable people, one of the challenges is so often folks would want to change strategy too frequently. And they would start to get themselves freaked out. You know, they'd look around and they'd say, well, wait, but you know, I'm doing a thing, but it's not working. Or I'm doing a thing, but wait, she's doing this other thing. Maybe I should be doing that.
Right, shiny object problem.
Yes. And ultimately, a lot of the time, I had to sort of be the bad guy and say, look, I know it's really exciting, but maybe you should keep doing that thing you're doing right now and give it some time to work. And I saw this time and again, and I realized that it's a real problem that for smart, capable people with a lot to give, if they quit too soon in their endeavors, they're never going to see progress because things just do take time. Sometimes it takes, you know, much more time than we want it to, but that is how things unfold. And so I wanted to help write a book so that people in that really difficult moment of not knowing whether something is not working or something is not working yet, so that they could make better and smarter choices and not give up too soon on the really valuable projects and goals that can make an impact.
I love that term, really that phrase, yet, not working yet, because many of us just go into the absolutes of it's working or it's not working. It's also just how friends and family colleagues might react because they want something very definitive in terms of that measure. Is it working right now? Have you hit your goals? Versus really evaluating it more on what's the progress that you've made. What really resonated with me at the beginning of the book was your statement. The first step is understanding that the key to a meaningful life is to set our terms for it. And that struck a chord so much because many of us have had definitions of what success looks like or should look like. A lot of it is based on short-term thinking or feeling or these societal norms or standards. Yet over time, I think all of us realize that those aren't the ones that really fit us best or matter most. And we know we need to do something different. We want to do something different, but it's really hard to make that transition. So what inhibits us from making that shift? So you've seen all these patterns. Why do we keep on doing this again and again and again?
Yes. Well, you raise a couple of really important points, Connie. And one in particular is there was a great quote that I cited in my first book, Reinventing You. And it was a quote by Longfellow. And it's that we judge ourselves by what we feel capable of, but other people judge us by what we've actually done. And of course, this is true. This makes sense. But it can often lead to a real disconnect because we know something will work. We have all the faith in the world. But until it's actually happened, all the people around us are skeptics. They're all like, well, you know, we'll believe it when we see it. And that's why we so often get caught off guard because we expect that the people around us, you know, our friends and family will be our biggest allies, our biggest boosters. And oftentimes they're not. They just decide that, okay, well, I'm going to be the devil's advocate because obviously she's not thinking this through. And it's like, oh my God, like all we do is think it through. And it's not helpful when people are like, gosh, Connie, have you ever considered blah, blah, blah? But you have to endure that.
It's always a negative. It feels like it's always the negative versus that's really interesting. How else can I support you? Or how have you reframed it this way? But I was just like, I've never seen it or heard it before. It feels different. And I'm not sure what to make of it. It doesn't help.
Yeah, exactly. So oftentimes there's a real burden psychologically that we have to bear because we might believe that we can do something, but we're not getting positive reinforcement from the people around us. Sometimes for quite a while, we're not getting actual results in the marketplace, and it can begin to erode your self-confidence over time. You look at the people around you who are carping, and you look at the results in the marketplace, which are not there yet, and you just begin to wonder, oh my gosh, you know, am I the one that's deluded here? And that is a really challenging place to be. And so it makes sense that a lot of people get discouraged and give up. But I think that too many probably do. And so in writing this book, I wanted to really help people be able to muscle through and accomplish some of the big things. And there's a few different ways they can do it. I mean, one that I talk about in The Long Game is a concept that I call looking for the raindrops. Because the truth is, where we often get off track is we're looking for like the big win, like the ultimate thing. Oh, well, she got the book contract, or oh, she got the keynote engagement, or she won the consulting contract. And, you know, that's wonderful, but it really takes a while for a lot of these things to happen. And in that in-between period, you can get very discouraged. And so the raindrops, it's like when a rainstorm's starting, you almost don't even believe it. You're like, was that a raindrop? And similarly, we need to specifically train ourselves to look for those signs. You know, maybe it's not that you're keynoting at the fancy conference for 30 grand. Maybe it's you get invited to speak for free at your local chamber of commerce, which doesn't sound very sexy. And if all you care about is the big win, you're going to poo-poo it and say, oh, but that's not a big thing. But you know what? A year or two ago, no one would have even known you were a speaker. A year or two ago, no one would have thought, oh, well, we definitely want her to speak, even if it's for free. So it's a sign of progress. And we have to see those things and recognize them. Maybe it's a nice note that someone sends to your boss. Maybe it's that more people are suddenly, you know, sending friend requests on LinkedIn. But those are the keys that we have to look for.
I walk away with it's about really redefining how you look at success, to your point. So it's not this big bang, but redefining it in such a way that you're making small steps that showcase that progress. It's those small signs that you're going in the right direction. these little wins, as I like to call it, are these, again, signs that point you in that direction of you're on the right path. I think a lot of us struggle with knowing if we're doing the right thing, because in many instances, we've been conditioned to think, is it right or wrong? It's very binary, but it's not necessarily about right or wrong. It's whether or not the effort that we're doing fits initially and it feels right. The metric may not be so specific, but if it feels right to you, your feeling can be a measure of success, and being okay with that feeling being a measure of success is valuable. So it's these small wins coming from, you know, in technology, having been in technology most of my life, agile development, you know, start small, iterate over time. But, you know, you have a goal in mind and being clear on that goal, first of all, something you also talk about sometimes, that we're not always clear of what that long game may be, because you have to define what those strategic goals are. So tell me about that too, because to build that foundation of long-term thinking, it does start with defining those right goals and to be strategic about how you pursue them. You gave us one solution, but how do you even start first? It like make sure you have the right goals to begin with.
Yeah, of course. This is crucial. And one of the first things that we have to gut check is, for so many of us, a lot of the goals that we have, or shall I say, think we have, are ones that have been kind of implanted in us by our parents or by society. There's sort of this implicit narrative of like, well, of course, you're going to march up the ladder and you're going to keep getting promoted, or you're going to do this and this and this. And that's what everyone wants, Connie. And it's like, oh, okay. Well, anytime something is the thing that everyone wants, it's actually ripe for a bit of a reexamination. If you actually legitimately do want that, then congrats, that's great. But it's also possible that you have perhaps subconsciously internalized other people's priorities. And so making sure that what we are aiming toward is actually what we want is really powerful and important. I have a story in the long game about a woman that I profile. She's actually a member of the Recognized Expert community named Rebecca Zucker. And Rebecca tells the story about how she was interviewing for M&A jobs, mergers and acquisition jobs. And she just kept doing interview after interview. And she said, I told them all I wanted to do was M&A, but all I wanted to do was cry. And she really did not want one of these jobs, but she just was kind of on autopilot. She was like, well, I guess I need to do this. But she actually took a step back, thankfully. And what she realized was she didn't want a banking job. She just wanted to be in Paris. That was where she was doing all of her interviews for banking. And so she found another way to be in Paris. She picked up a lot of freelance work. And ultimately, it was, you know, perhaps less prestigious to do these kind of random things, you know, the freelance here and the interview prep for MBA programs there. But it enabled her to have the space that she needed to figure out what she actually wanted to do. It turns out she likes helping people. She likes coaching people. And so when she re-entered corporate life, she got a job working in HR and talent and really liked it a lot, and ultimately became an executive coach and has her own practice. But it was only possible because she kind of stepped out of the frenzy of, oh, wow, I guess I need to just keep doing these interviews, and actually asked herself, well, what do I want in this situation?
You know, that brings up a really interesting point you also make in your book as to why many times we may not be able to frame up what we really want is because we're always so busy. And there's so many things that are going on that seem to be the real priorities, but they aren't. And so we're just moving again and again and again. And this perception of us being busy with all these things that seemingly are the steps towards the right goal aren't. But in society right now, folks are somewhat rewarded or is seen as, hey, wait, but you're so busy with all this, so you must be successful because your schedule is all packed, versus reevaluating is the 80% of the stuff that I'm doing really the right percentage of me feeling fulfilled or aligned with what it is that I truly want to do? And that, when I read that, that was so clarifying too. I'm like, yeah, we all get caught up in needing to feel like we need to do more, not what's right.
Yeah, it's so true. And studies have shown some interesting things. I mean, one is that people who work more than 50 hours a week are generally rewarded for it. They actually are paid, they're paid more. And ironically, simultaneously, studies have shown that people who work more than 50 hours a week are less productive
and less happy.
And definitely less happy. So a lot of this is just kind of ridiculous leftover optics stuff about, oh, wow, they must be working so hard. Look, you know, he never leaves his desk. And of course, when we're in the world of knowledge work, it really doesn't matter how much time you spend at your desk if you're burned out and you're not having good ideas anymore and you're making mistakes because you've been staring at a keyboard for 16 hours. So there's a real irony there. And of course, another interesting piece of research comes out of Columbia University from Sylvia Baletza and her colleagues. And that showed that, and I think this is interesting because when we look at how busy we all are, one of the things I think we have to look at is what are we getting out of being so busy? You know, yes, we are quote unquote forced to be. We all have lots of meetings, but are we deriving some kind of a benefit from it that makes it hard for us to extricate? And the answer is yes. Sylvia Baletza discovered that at least in most Western countries, there is a status that accrues to people who are perceived as being busy. And if you're really busy, then it must mean that you are high status because you are in demand. And there's a lot of people, frankly, who like feeling like that.
The parallels in that statistic and just perspective just reminds me of having worked in corporate or working with corporate clients where you see a lot of activity going on. But you ask them, well, what's the return that you're getting? You're doing all this work. What's the ROI? And I kind of think about that, putting it on us. It's that whether we're volunteering, signing up, or it's not voluntary, we are just engaging in all these various business activities. What's the return we're getting out of it? And measuring that return on something much bigger, which isn't strictly monetary, which isn't strictly title, power, status. It's now a lot of people looking at fulfillment and happiness. And are you really benefiting, to your point, from all of that?
Yeah, exactly.
Another concept that I thought was so valuable in helping people shift from that short-term thing to long-term thing was the optimize for interesting concept. So please share more about that, because as soon as I read that, I'm like, yes, that's so important. And it's such a shift because it's typically not optimized for interesting. It's this mentality that many of us have is optimized for what we think is right for us right now.
Yeah, absolutely. So in The Long Game, I talk, as you mentioned, about the concept of optimizing for interesting. And you know, as we're thinking about what our long-term goals are, this is the challenge, right? A lot of folks just really aren't sure. You say, well, you know, where do you want to go? What, you know, what is your path? And they're like, I don't know. And there's so much pressure, especially in our culture, to optimize for your passion. Well, Connie, what's your passion? Are you following your passion? And, you know, that's fantastic. If you have a passion, if you know what it is, then, you know, great, sure. Find a way to do it. That's wonderful. But a lot of people don't. They're not really sure. And they beat themselves up and they feel terrible because they don't know. They feel inadequate because they don't know. And so, you know, at the other end of the spectrum, there's a view that, like, if you don't really know what your passion is or whatever, then just optimize for money. Then just go be an investment banker. And I mean, okay, great. It's certainly nice to have a lot of money, but that's not a great answer either if that's not something you enjoy or if that's something that even makes you miserable. And so what I have proposed is what I consider to hopefully be a little bit of a kinder and gentler version of both of those things, a middle way, which I call optimize for interesting. Because the truth is, you might not know what your passion is, especially if you have been working incredibly hard, if you've been in a job that hasn't even allowed you the time to think about what you might want to do if you had free time, or if you were to have, God forbid, some fun, you know, you just like don't know. A lot of people feel very stuck about that and they feel bad. And what I say is, look, you don't have to know what your passion is, but I know that you have things that you think are interesting. Everybody inherently has some things. Some people, I mean, I have a friend who's coming to New York in a little while, and she says, you know, I'm like, so what do you want to do? She says, I want to go to the Museum of Math. And I'm like, yeah, wow. Amazing. I hope you have a really good time on your own at the Museum of Math. That's what's interesting to her. And we all have things like that. And that's what we should be thinking about. Not is it the, you know, my soulmate career, but it doesn't have to be a final answer. It's about, is it at least interesting? And you do it. And then you keep saying, well, is it still interesting? And if it is, you keep moving toward it. And if it's not, you pivot.
What was refreshing in learning about that concept is having the permission to not know. I think a lot of people feel they have to know because that's the pressure that you have put on you at a pretty early age, or at least, you know, years ago in that kind of career growth and development model, which is, what are you going to major in? Where are you going to go to school? Why are you going to this school? And what are you going to major in? What do you want to do? What all these things, like, define it. But a lot of us don't have a clue, and we're not given that permission to just try and say it's okay to try. It's certainly shifting. We're certainly that much more now that people are testing and learning and trying to figure out what fits them. I think that just leads into, again, another key concept in your book. It's the thinking in waves. So I'd love for you to share a little more about that too. So taking that optimized for interesting, and then how do you start operationalizing that?
Yeah, definitely. So in the spirit of continuing the conversation about how to be gentle with ourselves, one of the things that I have seen is when people are feeling like they're in a rut, when they feel stuck, often what they say is, oh, you know, I'm working so hard, you know, I'm trying so hard, and the results aren't coming, you know, nothing's happening. And you dig a little bit, and what you discover is, it's true, they are working really hard, but the reason that they are not succeeding the way they want is that they keep doing the same thing. And unfortunately, in order to be successful, sometimes you have to do different things and you have to know when to do the different thing. And that is the trick. And that's why I really advocate people internalize the framework of thinking in waves, because there are seasons for all kinds of different things. And, you know, just as one example, a lot of people that I know feel kind of bad about during the pandemic, they didn't make as much progress as they wanted. You know, oh, I was going to write that book. I was going to do blah, blah, blah. I was going to excel at work, but, you know, it just kind of all went by the wayside because maybe they had kids at home. They had to homeschool and you know, navigate this like Zoom classroom. Maybe they had caregiving needs. Maybe they were just like kind of freaked out and stressed out and they weren't at the top of their game, right? And I really want to encourage people to not feel bad about that. You did the best you could. But the key is to understand that there are waves. And that was a time when maybe you were over-indexing on, let's say, family responsibilities. And now is a time that you can begin to right the ship. It's not that everything has to be measured. You know, it's silly to say, oh, well, work-life balance means that every single day I'm going to spend X hours on family and X hours on showering and X hours on work and X hours on, you know, exercising. You can't do that on a daily basis. You have to stretch out that time frame and say, look, sometimes like when there's a pandemic, for months on end, you're going to be doing way too much family stuff. Now, it becomes a problem if that's all you ever do, because then you're going to hate your family. Eventually, it has to snap back, but it's over a time horizon and you can snap it back and over-index on work later. But it's the same way with our career progression. And so, for instance, when you first started a new job, or if you're starting out in your career, that's a time where it's all about learning. You know, don't try to be, you know, doing all kinds of crazy stuff. Your mandate is just like figure out what the heck's going on. Do that. But eventually you need to shift out of that You can't just be learning all the time, like the perennial student or whatever. Like, of course we learn, but you actually have to start doing things too. You have to start contributing your own knowledge. And that becomes important so that people understand, well, she actually has something of her own to contribute. Oh, I actually really like her ideas. And so you begin this process of shifting how you are in your company and in your career. And that's how we begin to think in waves.
It's this constant shift in fluidity that you have of moving dynamically based on the situation that you're in, but we're all very much taught originally to think in a more linear, sequential, siloed, and kind of rigid fashion. But in light of where we need to move towards now to see what aligns best, it is to your point, like, well, how do we figure out for this period, this is what may work and give us the permission to pursue that more wholeheartedly. And that balance will be different than what may occur a little bit in the future. We might be doing something different. But your point about a lot of us just feeling stuck and not making as much progress as we want, it resonates in that we're also hard on ourselves and we don't like failure and we're not patient. Some things that obviously you also talk about, which is the importance of having that strategic patience and rethinking failure and one's ability to truly move forward despite challenges and setbacks. But what does it really take to still keep at it and shift the negative thinking that a lot of us commonly have? We do so all the time. I know I've done it. Try not to, but it's hard. How do we reframe failure or what we may perceive as a lack of progress so that we can still have that long-term thinking and not be distracted or feel dejected in what we're doing right now?
Yeah, this is a really important point. And this is something, there's a whole chapter on rethinking failure in The Long Game. And ultimately, one of the things that I like to say is it is to a certain extent a framing question. Because if you are holding things lightly, and if you were thinking about things as experiments, you know, is it actually a failure if you say, I'm going to try a few things, let's see what happens, and then something doesn't happen? Like, okay, did you fail? Like, you know, that seems like it seems like a very harsh way to put it. Like, I mean, it's like if you and I went to a casino and you like had $10 and you like put a dollar down on a bunch of different squares. Like, okay, you know what, Connie? You lost $10. Who cares? Like, at the end of the day, no one cares if you lose $10. The problem happens when you lose $1,000,000. It's all about degree and scope. And so if you place little bets, it literally doesn't matter if you fail, because failure is too big of a term for whatever has happened. You place little bets and you get data from that. And then you just keep moving forward with that data. I think that's one way to think about it. Another, in The Long Game, I actually tell a story about a woman named Dana Del Valle. And I love her story because, you know, something I really believe is that there are always multiple paths to success. And Dana was someone who really, really wanted to be an actress. And she wanted to move to California and become a famous Hollywood celebrity. And it didn't work. It didn't happen because, unfortunately, right out of college, she had an unexpected pregnancy. And she decided that really her only move was to move back home to her family, which was in the border of North Dakota and Minnesota, and raise her son there. So there's, you know, not exactly Hollywood. And so she had to come up with a different dream. And you might say, well, you know, I haven't heard of Dana. You know, she hasn't won any Oscars. I guess she failed. But the interesting part is if you peel it back, Dana, first of all, invented a career for herself where she became a nonprofit arts executive in her community. And for the past decade, she's run this arts nonprofit where she's been able to be involved in creative industries every day of her life. And secondly, she actually built up a regional acting career where she does commercials, she does voiceovers. And she said that she actually has a number of friends who did move to New York or who did move to Los Angeles. And she has had a bigger career than they have because they kept going to audition after audition, getting rejected. Meanwhile, she has become this big fish in a small pond and has been able to have a really robust local acting career in Minnesota. So is that a failure? I would say no.
I would agree. And do you think so much of this reframing, the challenge of us reframing is that it's just our natural tendency to think almost too deeply and myopically first, like, oh, it's this thing and I have to be good at this thing right now, not giving ourselves the time and energy to say, wait a second, again, big picture, what am I really trying to do? And is the effort of doing this in this way, it doesn't have to be perfect. That's why it's just getting us stuck. I know I've been probably guilty of that. Just looking at way too myopically. It's like, wait a second, does it really matter in the end?
No, it's so true. I mean, we all tend as humans to just get fixated where we assume that there is one path to our goal. So, oh, well, it must be this. I want to do this. And so therefore it must be that. And there's usually a lot of ways in. I mean, I have a coaching client named Aviva Leggett, who's a very successful college admissions expert. And she runs a college admissions consultancy. And she just published her new book. It's called Get Real and Get In from St. Martin's Press. And, you know, it makes me think about the college quest, right? Like you might be, and you know, you could excuse it in a kid, but it's like so many of us lead our lives this way. It's like, if I don't get into Penn, I'm going to die.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay.
It's absolute. It feels so absolute.
But you know, people have a vision and, oh, it has to be this vision. But the whole way that life seems to work is, you know, we set our goals, and a phrase that I use, I have an article in this month's Harvard Business Review called, you know, stuck or stymied, use strategic patience to move forward, which is based on the long game. And I talk about the importance of being directionally correct, right? Like it's just unrealistic to assume for anybody. I mean, I think we can recognize this with other people. It's a little harder to recognize it with ourselves, but it's just unrealistic that you say, oh, you know what my plan is? My plan is blah, blah, blah. And then it's like literally everything that you say along the path is going to work out. Like really? Every single thing? I don't think so. There's going to be stuff that doesn't work. There's going to be no's. There's going to be rejections. There's going to be, oh my God, I was going to work with this editor and then they left and blah, blah, blah. And you have to figure it out. You have to pivot a little bit. And the goal is not necessarily to walk in the exact footsteps that you carved out and said, oh, it has to be this. It's like, you know what? Just keep moving north. You said you wanted to go north. Like, okay, look at the sun and just try to go in that direction and you will figure it out. And maybe it'll take a little longer than you thought. Maybe, okay, well, you get a little turned around and then you were going a little west there. But like, try to keep going north and generally it will work.
How does someone measure for being directionally correct? In a world that we're in, particularly in marketing, as you know, what's the measure? Now that everything can be measured, people want to know what's the stat. But when it's your own life, it can feel really hard to put a measure on it, but yet you feel the pressure of those markers.
Yes.
So what would directionally correct feel like?
So directionally correct, I think one thing that really should not be underestimated in this process is your networks and the people around you. And, you know, in fact, in the long game, there's a whole chapter about building relationships and connections, because I think it's so important. I would venture to say that for many of us, when we are in the thick of this process of trying to reach a goal, trying to reach a certain path, we can't trust ourselves. We are very unreliable in that moment because we are prone to either getting way too discouraged and say, oh God, it's never going to happen. It's never going to work. I might as well give up now. Or we become way too bullheaded. And even when something is like, okay, all right, you've been doing this for 10 years. It's still not happening. No, it's going to work. It's going to work. Like at a certain point, there is a golden mean here, and you don't want to be the last person clinging to a life raft. You don't want to be the person that's jumping ship too soon. And it's hard for us to tell. And so that is why I think one of the things that's really essential is for all of us to think about building communities, building friendships and networks with people that are knowledgeable about the path that you're trying to take, you know, professional colleagues. Like, it's great to have people around you that just love you. But what is even more useful in this circumstance is to have people around you who care about you, but also sort of know what it takes to do the thing you want to do. It doesn't mean they have to literally have done it themselves, but they need to be familiar enough with the ecosystem that they are a good gauge and they can tell you, you know, Connie, this is a really good idea. I feel like you should keep at it. Or, you know, maybe you should start to think about X, Y, and Z and just level with you. Because if you're able to essentially outsource to people that you already have decided that you believe and you trust, that is what can save us from going off the deep end at times.
I look at that too as getting valuable sources of data points. Right? It's data. As you talk to these people that you trust, as you mentioned, who may or may not have exactly walked that path, but they've got enough understanding and insight of what you're trying to do, they give you a different lens for you to look at whether or not that might be successful or not. So when you talk to enough people, they're like, oh, yes, I get what you're doing. It makes sense. Have you thought about this way? Have you thought that way? But it gives you all these valuable data points to help you move in that direction that you want to move forward in. And, you know, you also in the book share some really good milestones that are helpful in setting expectations on how long it actually takes to get that traction. As you mentioned, it's like, God, you know, some people think, oh yeah, I could get to wherever I want to go in 3 months, in 6 months. You're like, no, this really is a long game. So could you please share that? Because I think everyone's looking for a benchmark. So many people want to know, well, how long is it? What's that benchmark? And so when you provide that, it's always really helpful so people can reframe that expectation that it's not an immediate thing that happens.
Yeah, absolutely. So what I have seen, and, you know, asterisk, things vary in different fields and professions and things like that. But something that was the case for me, and at least among folks who were in my recognized expert community, which there's now 600 plus people who have been through the program, I've actually seen that it takes somewhere between 2 and 3 years to begin to show even, you know, like any minor signs of progress and momentum. I want to be really clear about that. And it usually takes about 5 years to start showing major signs of progress and momentum. And that might sound, you know, oh my God, that's so long. But you know what? The time is going to pass anyway. And the question is, 2 years from now, 5 years from now, would you like your business to be the same as it is now? Would you like to be earning the same amount of money or working with the same clients or doing the same things? Or would you like to have done something, to have injected a new variable so that things are different? And for me personally, the whole reason that I embarked on the quest to try to become a recognized expert myself was I realized, you know, my business, I was sure it would continue growing in one capacity or another, but it would only grow incrementally rather than exponentially. You know, when you have a business that's all about referrals, people know people like themselves. And I was not working with incredibly wealthy people or incredibly wealthy companies. And so it was going to limit me. And I knew that I needed to somehow grow my profile so that I could be attracting new clients to me and build my brand and my credibility. And so that was what I focused on. But what I've seen and among folks in the recognized expert community, 2 or 3 years in, I mean, often you can start writing for high-profile publications, but you know, there's ups and downs with all these kinds of things, right? It's like you get a piece in, and then oh, well, that other one was rejected. Or, you know, oh, you start to get invited on podcasts, but, you know, oh, but it's not like, you know, a super famous podcast. You know, people are always playing it down, but it's really important, again, to recognize those raindrops and to realize, oh, you know, this really is a sign of momentum. I really am getting somewhere. And when you realize that, by the time you continue putting in the effort, by the time you hit year five, you have actually done such yeoman's work that other people are not willing to do, that you have put a major distance between yourself and the competition.
There's a saying that somebody had on my podcast, had was persistence beats resistance. And which I thought was so, it was so resonant, because it's true, is that if it's something that you're optimizing for interesting, you are feeling that it's directionally correct, those years don't feel as long because you're enjoying it. You're starting to realize what fits at the end of the day, and that you really can move forward in such a way that does create this incredible momentum. And learning from these people in the book who are just like everyone else, but in particular, you know, for somebody who's as accomplished as you, you also share your story of talent stacking and pursuing another interest of writing Broadway musicals and pursuing that, which was also very inspiring too. I'd love if you wouldn't mind just sharing just a little bit of that journey, because it shows the progress, but also the fear that a lot of us have faced when you're doing something new, but there's a really strong interest in pursuing it.
Yes, I'm glad to. I really wanted in the long game to try to just, you know, level the playing field and not be this kind of omniscient narrator, but to let people know that I was trying to walk the path as well. And so one of the stories that I tell is about my efforts to learn to write musical theater. In 2016, I created a 10-year plan for myself. And that was that by 2026, I would have a show that was on Broadway. And I am about halfway through this process now. So, I mean, we'll see how I do in terms of getting a show to Broadway. But I have been working the program, and I started from really legit not knowing how to write musical theater at all, to the point where it was just incredibly humiliating, because I would find myself in rooms with people who are experts at it, and I had no idea. To now actually, you know, sort of knowing what I'm doing. I've written a complete musical. I have completed a pretty prestigious musical theater training program. I've now built relationships and built a network with a lot of producers and a lot of people in the Broadway ecosystem. So I feel like I'm getting there, but it is true that anytime you were engaging in a new activity, and this is something that's fairly rare for adults, you really do have to humble yourself. You really do have to, you know, I mean, for me, my mantra was just like, okay, Dory, it's okay that you're not that good at this, because you derive your self-esteem from other areas of your life. That is okay.
Totally understand that. Completely understand that. Well, I'd love to close out the podcast with some questions I always ask guests. And one of which is, how has your definition of career success evolved from your early days in the workforce to now? And what was so important for you to do in order to progress the way you wanted so you could achieve the right fit for you personally and professionally?
Well, I think early on, I had just a much more linear view of career success. I had started as a journalist, and I thought, oh, you know, my definition of success is to kind of move up the ladder and keep getting better and better positions at bigger and bigger papers. And it really was just a vision of a march toward a fairly predictable future. And what I've come to understand is none of it's predictable. We're making it all up. And ultimately, the ability to be to have long-term plans, but also to be nimble in their execution is really where it's at.
And to close, what's the best work or career advice you've ever received?
The best work or career advice I have ever received is, now it's everybody's advice. But when I first started my business, I had a colleague say, you know, you don't actually have to have an office. You can save a lot of money if you work from home. And now the world agrees.
And finally, what is the best way listeners can connect with you and, of course, get your great book?
Connie, thank you so much. Well, the new book is The Long Game, How to Be a Long-Term Thinker in a Short-Term World. And if folks want to get in touch and learn more about that, and especially I have a free resource, which is The Long Game Strategic Thinking Self-Assessment. Folks can download that for free at doryclark.com/the-long-game.
And listeners, you should absolutely do so because all the resources that Dory ever puts up, also in her newsletters. So if you haven't signed up, please sign up for Dory's newsletters. They're always really insightful and inspirational. And, you know, she's walked the walk and can definitely talk the talk. And it's something that you could so connect to. So thank you so much, Dory, for being on the show today and sharing really great perspective on how to shift this short-term mindset that we all have into one that can set us up for success in the long term.
Connie, thanks so much for having me.
One of the things that I fully believe in is taking that test and learn approach to your career. But oftentimes, how do you know those experiments are working or not? I mean, we hear it a lot, and having worked in technology, we all know it's about starting small, iterating, optimizing along the way. But what are those measures of success? We want to know something's working, right? To determine whether or not we pivot or we stay the course. And what really resonated with me is Dory's comments about looking for the raindrops. And to me, that was that metaphor for trying to find those signs. And those signs may not be just this concrete and hard measure, but in fact, a feeling, or maybe this small little win that shows that you're making progress along the way. Because to her point, it's not about this big win, this big bang opportunity that we're trying to get, or maybe that big contract or whatever it is that you're looking for, but really these small but meaningful signs of success, those raindrops that highlight to you that you're doing something right. And you can also continue to get that data from people too. So not only will there be signs out there that help guide you, but as you build that network, as she talks about, these conversations are also, in my mind, raindrops, because they're sources of data that can help point you in the right direction, maybe help you pivot in a different direction, or confirm that the direction that you're going in is right.
Thanks for listening to Strategic Momentum. To connect with me, you can find me on LinkedIn at Connie W. Steele or on Instagram at Connie Wang Steele. If you've liked what you heard, please follow the show and share this episode with friends and colleagues. You can also get show notes, links, and more tips and advice from this episode at strategicmomentum.co. I'm Connie Steele, and you've been listening to the Strategic Momentum Podcast.